There's absolutely no doubt that appearing before the family court is stressful for all involved, and in the past few years there have been government inquiries and reviews into how the court might work better. The latest report by the Law Reform Commission was handed down, heavens above, in March. But before the government has found time to respond to the recommendations in that report, another parliamentary review has, as we all know, been announced. Kulu Kalei O'Frabjus Day. This will be chaired by Liberal MP Kevin Andrews, and his deputy will be, Pauline Hanson. Pauline is taking credit for pushing for the inquiry and has already expressed her views on where the problems lie in the family court. She claims it's women lying to the court about their abusive partners to get custody. Now, to get a broader picture of the issues, I'm pleased to welcome back Jess Hill. Jess is an award-winning investigative journalist who, among other things, has been researching domestic violence for more than 5 years, and she's written the book on the subject, which I'm cradling, Look What You Made Me Do, published by Black Ink. And Jess, welcome back to a program you once helped produce.
I did indeed, Philip. It's great to be on this end of the phone.
Now, you admit that before you started your research into domestic violence, you believed, like Pauline, that men were getting a raw deal in the family court. Why did you think that? Simply anecdotal?
Yeah, well, you know, more than 40% of Australians think that not only do men get a raw deal, but that women routinely make up abuse allegations to get their way. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I think I was, as, you know, victim to internalized misogyny and old ideas about women not being trusted as anyone. But if you trace it back to when the idea actually really took hold in family law, the breadcrumb trail kind of takes us back to the 1980s. And there's this American psychiatrist called Richard Gardner. He came up with this syndrome called parental alienation syndrome, and he claimed that 90% of abuse allegations in family law were false and that they were made by vindictive parents, who were mainly mothers, who were pressuring their children to make these false claims, especially of sexual abuse, just to punish ex-husbands and stop them from seeing their children. Now, his cure for this syndrome that he kind of came up with was to remove the child from the alienating parent, so usually the mother, and place them with the alleged abuser, and would often recommend that the children have no contact at all with the mother for months at a time. Now, this guy became very influential in the US courts. He personally testified hundreds of times, had a great deal of influence here in Australia and in the UK. But what's most disturbing is this contradiction at the heart of what Gardner was saying, which was that 90% of sexual abuse allegations made in the family law context were false, but he also wrote that sexual relations between adults and children were ubiquitous, but he didn't see any problem with that. In fact, he said that essentially the problem wasn't in the act, but in the reaction it provoked from society. And it seems pretty clear that him coming up with parental alienation syndrome was basically a way to cover up allegations of abuse in the family law courts and protect fathers from having custody removed from them and to punish mothers for even raising these allegations.
Now, has there been any, I mean, that what you've just told me is quite extraordinary, and what a creature. Has there been any objective research done on the realities, on how the courts treat claims of abuse and whether it is biased one way or the other?
Yeah, so, you know, as you can imagine, research can be difficult to come by just on in terms of how many deliberately false allegations are there, you know, because you've got to be able to substantiate whether the allegations are false or not. But we do have, so there's one particular study that is cited a lot from Canada. It's, you know, it's about 20 years old, but these things don't change a great deal over time. And it's especially interesting because it happened at the same time as a parliamentary inquiry into the family law system, where the same old things were coming up, that women routinely use abuse allegations as a weapon in family law courts, etc. This was a huge study of child protection cases in Canada, you know, over, I think it was 18,000. And what it found was that when it came to deliberately false allegations of abuse in a custody context, that this was happening it was still reasonably rare. It was happening at about 12% of the time. But interestingly, the false abuse allegations were made most commonly by non-custodial parents who were usually fathers. So that was about 43% of that total 12%. The next most common was from neighbors or relatives. Then it was custodial parents, usually mothers. That was 14%. And then children made deliberately false allegations 2% of the time, which is to say almost never. So, you know, what that study, I guess, shows us is that, you know, if we're trying to foreground this idea that women lie, I mean, that's just all harking back to hoary old notions.
And you feel confident that you can extrapolate from Canada to Australia?
Absolutely. I think, well, the family law system is incredibly similar across the Western world. And I think that I can't imagine that in Australia we have just some pocket of women who are completely unlike any other women in the developed world who make up all these lies. And certainly we don't see that coming up. I mean, the false allegation rate in the family courts hovers around the 10% mark. So it's not like it's a major issue, no matter who's making it.
Talking to Jess Hill. Jess, let's move on to some legislative reform in 2006 that made parents reluctant to report abusive partners. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this, you know, in 2006 we were in a bit of a similar environment to now, only much less understanding about domestic abuse and much less awareness. But essentially same sort of result. We had, you know, the fathers' rights groups had been campaigning virulently for years, and the Howard government responded by introducing these new reforms to the Family Law Act. And essentially, on the face of it, they all looked pretty reasonable. It was the idea that, you know, judges should apply a presumption of shared parental responsibility. So, you know, children should have a right to a relationship with both parents. Who wouldn't agree with that? You know, sounds great. And they put a caveat in that unless violence or abuse was an issue. But then there was a catch, and this is what former family court judge Richard Chisholm called the victim's dilemma. And that was that if a parent alleged abuse, they could be labelled a hostile parent, which meant they were unwilling to support this shared parenting that was becoming the sort of, you know, number one ideology of the family court system. And then what would happen is if they brought up an allegation of abuse, they ran the risk of losing custody of their children altogether or could be blocked from seeing or even speaking to them for months. And the result was, as we saw in multiple studies that followed those reforms, was that basically the whole victim's dilemma is, do I report the family violence to the court and risk losing my children, or should I stay silent and risk my children being harmed or killed? That's a direct result of those reforms, and that's why they made more reforms in 2012 to essentially try to repair the harm that was done in 2006.
I want you now to talk to another phrase which sort of echoes through this whole area, and that is parental alienation.
Yeah, so parental alienation. Well, I mean, parental alienation harks back to Richard Gardner. He was the inventor of the syndrome of parental alienation. Really, the core problem that I think is facing the family law courts, especially when it comes to the safety of children, is that there is a pattern that has been at play for quite a few years now and has not been stopped by further reforms to try to protect children. And that is that if a protective parent, who usually is the mother but not always, alleges abuse, the parent that has had the abuse alleged against them can counterclaim that the children have been alienated or that they've been brainwashed or that they are enmeshed, whatever synonym you want to use, and that is the reason why these abuse allegations are coming up. Now, essentially, parental alienation is still being used to cover up abuse allegations and, you know, to the point where, you know, for the family law courts, if there are abuse allegations made, quite often the families will need to go and get a family report written that will be provided to the judge that assesses the dynamics of the family and whether there is harm being done and how to sort of look at assigning custody. And in report after report that has crossed my desk, and for a lot of, you know, in a lot of cases where children have been removed from their protective parents and handed over to the parent with allegations against them, you see these terms coming up, alienated or brainwashed or enmeshed, that the women have a pathological belief system that the children have been abused. There's this sense that by using terms that are similar to parental alienation, basically, psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, people who write these reports are essentially convincing the courts that the abuse never happened. And then horrific custody decisions are being made, literally where I've seen so many cases in which children who have themselves disclosed abuse to police, to counsellors, to the court system, to child protection, that they have been removed from their mothers mostly, handed over to their fathers, and even had contact entirely closed off between them and their mothers for months at a time. And then only after those months, supervised access had been reinstated, in which the mother commonly has to pay per hour to see her child.
God help us. Now, let the record show that regardless of allegations, fathers retain visiting or parenting rights in 97% of cases, just 3%. Yeah. Of fathers lose all access.
Yeah, that's right. And when you consider that, really, I mean, the family law courts are almost by default family violence courts because, it's up to about 70% or so of cases that actually go to a hearing involve allegations of physical or emotional abuse. Around half actually involve allegations of actual physical abuse. So when you think about that, and then think about the fact that, okay, one in four women in Australia has experienced physical or sexual violence from an intimate partner. We have some studies, not so large as the studies on women, but we do have studies that say that about one in four children have also experienced family violence. So if you consider that, and then we're hearing that only 3% of fathers are denied access, what you're hearing is that only the very pointiest end of those violent fathers are being denied access to their children.
Jess, you've had a chance to look at the recommendations from the report that the Law Reform Commission produced on the family law system that were only tabled in March this year. Mm. One of the interesting recommendations is that the family law bundle go back to the states. I think you think there's some merit in that?
Yeah, well, look, I don't claim to be an expert on what should happen. I kind of like, you know, as journalists, we just identify problems. but I think that given that, and this is what the Law Reform Commission report said, is that given that the issues of child protection and family violence are dealt with at the state level, so intervention orders, child protection cases, all of this is state-based. And then we have a family law court system that's federal. And so you have this enormous gap that children are falling through. You know, and it's like, well, if we've got the expertise and we're dealing with all of these matters at this state level, why are we making families go through multiple court systems? So you go through one court system for your intervention order, you go through another court system for a child protection case, you know, through the children's court, and then you have to go through the family law courts as well. And when you go through the family law court and you get a parenting order, well, that overrides any intervention order that you have. So if you've got an intervention order saying that, you know, your ex-partner can't come within 100 metres of the house, well, the family law order might say that he's able to come and pick the kids up from the house, and that overrides the intervention order. So you've got these systems working at cross purposes.
You know, we're talking about the men, the women, the kids. I suddenly have a surge of sympathy for the judges. It must be the most dreadful, you know, the most dreadful life on the bench, trying to make these decisions.
Yeah, and you know, there are judges who make better decisions than others, and unfortunately, I've come across the same judges making pretty horrific decisions time after time. Interestingly, former Attorney General Robert McClelland who really championed the 2012 reforms that tried to sort of undo the harm of the Howard reforms. He's now a family court judge, sat in his courtroom, and he does a very good job. But then you've got other justices, like, for example, Tim Carmody, and I quoted him in the Guardian article that I wrote last week. And, you know, just to quote him quickly here, just to show how exceptional the circumstances need to be to prevent an abusive father having contact with their children. In a 2007 judgment, Justice Tim Carmody, who was Queensland's Chief Justice for a while, said that the consequences of denying contact between the abusive parent, usually the father, and the child may well be as serious as the risk of harm from abuse. There is no presumption or a priori rule that even gross misbehaviour such as child sexual abuse puts up an insurmountable barrier in the way of having contact with a child victim. And that's just staggering, I think. I mean, that.
I'm certainly staggered, yeah. Do you think that this new review, which seems more like a stunt than anything, is another case of just kicking the can down the road?
Look, yes, but I don't think that's the main reason why it's being done. I mean, it's pretty clear, and most commentary has pointed to the fact that this is just a way of bringing Pauline into the tent. Which is abominable. Like, I mean, you know, given all the talk we've had on, oh, it's a bipartisan approach to reducing domestic violence and, you know, this is a national emergency. I mean, all the rhetoric that we hear from politicians and the government. And then they're pretty happy to just horse trade away the safety of children and family violence survivors for Pauline's votes. I just think that's appalling.
Well, you're concerned that what we'll hear will be a series of anecdotal evidence, or a lot of anecdotal evidence, that won't be fact-checked.
Yeah, precisely. Like, Philip, I can't tell you how many people have contacted me with their family law cases, you know, giving me long, detailed explanations of how they've been screwed over or how their children have been endangered. And I would never report on that without being able to go back to the judgments, without being go back to the court documents. And yet we've now got this national grievance tour that is going to hear the stories of all these people. Well, what's to stop people from just coming in and making up a whole heap of crap, or just saying what they believe to be true but maybe is not an objective opinion on what's happened? So I think that, like, you know, to get people's impressions of what's happening in the family law system, fine. But if that's the primary objective of this, we're going to get taken down so many rabbit holes and we won't know what's what.
Jess, good on you. Jess Hill, investigative journalist and author of the book Look What You Made Me Do, published by Black Ink. Good on you, Black Ink.